This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean County and Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.5 in Lincoln, covering most of Central Illinois. We hope to have a great show for you today. I'm here with my wife, Lynn, and we've been gone for a couple of weeks here. Lynn and I went on a fall trip here about 2 weeks ago, and then last week, I think John ran into some technical trouble and was very, very busy. Our chief engineer, he was out about in the countryside. You probably saw him bobbing and weaving and jumping around up and down out there, maybe in a very colorful fall costume, we hope. But if not, he was out there.
He was dangling from the tower.
Right, faithfully and dutifully doing his job. He might have had to climb up a 250 or 300-foot tower. You never know. And at any rate, we're back, and we're glad to be back. Last week, again, we were gone, but our show is brought to you by you. You want to remember. And so if you can help us out with a donation, we would surely appreciate that. You can go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com, and it'll show you how to make a donation if you prefer to do that. There is other information on the website, and you can find out a lot about us. So be sure to visit. And in the meantime, I want to turn this over to my wife if she has anything to say about our trip and being gone and whatever else. So before we get started, I want to mention what today's topic will be. The topic will be the real issue, or things are never what they appear to be. And we'll jump into that issue just as soon as we hear from Lynn.
Oh, boy. Didn't tell me one thing. Have you ever known me not to have something to say?
No.
Well, we'll start from there then. I say hello to everybody out there. Windy out, but the sun's shining. Boy, that's good. Not good for the leaves. The wind is blowing from the wrong direction. The kids were going to come over and break for us today, but I don't know if they will or not with all this wind.
Well, I was sort of hoping that it would blow across the street, you know, from the west. If it blew from the west, it would blow the leaves across the street over into
a field
across from us, an empty field. And we could get rid of all of our leaves that way, but I don't think it's going to be blowing that way this afternoon. So we'll see how windy it gets and what we can do.
Now, today is Halloween, and tomorrow is the Feast of All Souls and All Saints.
Yes, it is, and usually we have our Halloween show, but it's a little late for it. You know, by the time this airs, it'll be all
over with.
It'll be past Halloween, so.
But November is dedicated to the poor souls in purgatory, so tuck them in your prayers this month. You know, help them get out of purgatory with your prayers and sacrifices. Y'all have a friend for eternity. They'll pray for you in exchange. It's a pretty good deal, you know. Well, Bob, how is it you ordered that?
Today's topic?
Yes.
Okay, it's called The Real Issue, or Things Are Never What They Appear to Be. And it's in relation to what's going on today and perhaps our election coming up. I hope everyone prays for a peaceful election and for a peaceful transfer of power, or you know, continuance of power as things go on, and that we avoid a lot of the predictions of disturbances and violence that are being made. So pray for that, and we'll go from there. And our topic today, the real issue, or things are never what they appear to be, will be related a little bit to a lot to what's going on today. So
right, with the voting and such. Archbishop Vigano came out with the second letter to the Pope. No, to the President, I'm sorry. To President Trump. And this, what Bob's going to talk about, pretty well related. So go to it, Bob.
A lot of this relates to the, at any rate, again, what is the real issue? Have you ever wondered about that? You know, what is going on? Why at this particular time in our country is race or systemic racism being trotted out as the issue of the day? A lot of the things we can look back in the past and ask ourselves, you know, what was the real issue about what was going on? I mean, for example, why were the people in Vietnam back in 1960 during the Vietnam War fighting that war and fighting for a revolution? Did it really center around the various issues of the day that they were talking about, or did it center around something else? And also, if you want to look back at our past, and I'm going back, say, to the time that I was in college back in the 1960s, huge inroads were made during the 1960s and after the 1960s in alleviating poverty. We had the war on poverty, and we spent trillions of dollars in alleviating these issues. We did a lot to alleviate the race issue. We changed laws. We ended a lot of the Jim Crow era and tried to promote better relations between the races. Why all of a sudden now, after so much progress, is this becoming an issue? There was all kinds of other theories going on that time, a fear of communism, the Cold War. What were the real issues of that were going on then? If we go back in our history to the Civil War and the disunion we had, why did it really happen? Was it strictly, over slavery? Was our nation in such a sad state that the people were so split on everything back at that time? Or was there something more going on all that time? We can go back even and take a look at our Revolutionary War period. And that's a good period to take a look at. Why did the Revolutionary War really happen? If you take a look at the time, America was doing, the colonists were doing extremely well. The wages were high. There were there's a lot of work. There was land available, people moving out, onto the frontier and places. People were probably in America, Englishmen in America, were as well off as any people anywhere in the world. During the time that the Boston Tea Party took place, there was an economic boom, and taxes were low. The cost of government was small. Various laws that were unpopular were being changed and modified so that citizens really did not have that much to complain about. In fact, a lot of the issues of the day had to be stirred up. I mean, what was going on? Why did that happen? And we can look back and see the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, all kinds of topical and current reasons were given for these things, but was that what was really going on? And also, in talking about all of these things, what has all of this to do with Catholicism, you might ask? I mean, what has this to do with the issue of the Catholic Church, or even the issue of religion or Christianity, for that matter? And that's what we're going to get at. And to do that, I want to read from an article in the New Oxford Review, and the article is in the October 2020 issue of the New Oxford Review. It's by Jason M. Morgan, and I think Jason Morgan is a historian who teaches history at the university level, and he has an article in there called Sons of Liberty, Sons of Anarchy, and we're going to read from that article and see if it can shed some light on why things are never what they seem to be, and what is the real issue that is going on today, and what was the real issue maybe going on with a lot of the events that I just talked about and named. So we'll go from there. He starts the article out with a quote from a poem by Matthew Arnold, Dover Beach. And Matthew Arnold was an English poet and of the 19th century, I think, pretty late 19th century, at least the 1850s or later, somewhere in there, perhaps a little bit later than that. And he says in the poem, "And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused armies of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." He's talking about struggle and armies clashing in the night, meaning that, you know, in other words, they don't really know exactly why they are fighting and what they are doing. And the whole poem concerns the demise of Christianity. He sees in the beginning of the poem, "At one time, Christianity was like a bright girdle furled all around the world. And during the 19th century, a lot of people saw the beginning of the demise of Christianity in the coming of the modern state that was overwhelming it, and the descent from a Christian-based country, nation, people, into a more modern, harder, materialistic, and perhaps more confused time and people." And this is what he was talking about in the poem. And this is the theme that sweeps through this article by Jason Morgan, "Sons of Liberty, Sons of Anarchy." And so we'll read from that article, and I think as we read along, it will begin shedding light on that issue that I was talking about, what is the real issue, and things are never what they really seem to be. And we have a lot of that going on today. We have this so-called issue of systemic racism or racism, but is it? Is it really the issue? And in a lot of the events that we talked about, in the cataclysmic events that shake this earth, and especially that have been shaking things in the late 19th and early 20th century, is that ever the real issue? Is there something else beneath that issue that we should be aware of? But at any rate, Jason Morgan says here, in an article in The American Conservative, June 17th, Will Collins suggests that the pandemonium surrounding the death of George Floyd, while in the custody of Minnesota police, has become America's version of the Dreyfus Affair, that brouhaha in France during which the Third Republic came apart at the seams over a cut-rate forgery and hit job against a nominally Jewish member of the French military. And if you know anything about Alfred Dreyfus. He was a Jewish person, pretty much a secular Jewish person. The family was never really very religious and mostly just secular. And he was not a particularly, you know, outstanding person. He was a good, solid, loyal person in the French army. And he was accused of spying for the Germans. And, of course, none of it turned out to be true later on. He was punished. He was tried, convicted, and punished. He was sent, I think, to Devil's Island and spent maybe about 5 years there, mostly in solitary confinement. And he was eventually released. The whole affair, you know, was Trump was a hoax. It wasn't real. And he was never a spy. And all of that came out. But the whole point of it, the thing was, this, the Dreyfus Affair and the anti-Judaism that was going on at the time really had nothing much to do with Dreyfus, and it was about another issue altogether, and that's what the article is getting at. It says, in many ways, the analogy is apt. As Hannah Arendt explicates at length in The Origins of Totalitarianism, 1951, the Dreyfus Affair rent French society, becoming sort of a rallying cry, dividing one half of France from the other. Virtually overnight, both Alfred Dreyfus and George Floyd became rallying cries. And again, the rallying cry in the modern Black Lives Movement, at least right at the present time, and in the last 4 or 5, 6 months or so, has been the death of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police. And it says, one side girds for battle, the other braces for the blow. In that sense, the Dreyfus Affair parallels what is happening in our streets today. Dreyfus, a most unremarkable person in his own right, happened to be standing right over the place where a fault line suddenly split France in two. the figure of George Floyd under the knee of Officer Derek Chauvin, or Chauvin, has become the hinge on which America is now seen to turn. So Morgan here is comparing the two incidents. The Dreyfus affair set off a whole series of rioting and split the population in France, one side against the other. And it was simply an excuse, a pretext for what was already happening in France, the society being divided, and a whole cauldron of opposition boiling up in that society. And the Dreyfus affair was an excuse for it to take place. And this is what Morgan is saying, the same thing with George Floyd. He is simply a rallying symbol. And like Dreyfus, he was not a particularly remarkable man. George Floyd actually had a history of criminality. I don't know if it was anything big, but nevertheless, just in and out of trouble with the police and so forth. And pretty much not a outstanding person. There was never, you know, not any central spotlight on him for anything, not some kind of a great person or anything. More similar to Dreyfus in that sense, although, you know, Alfred Dreyfus was a decent and upstanding military person in the French army, neither particularly outstanding in the sense of being, you know, and known, and just like George Floyd wasn't known, but happened to be in the right place at the right time for a split that was going on in society. And it goes on here, it says, but if the Dreyfus analogy is pursued a bit further, it leads us not deeper into the history of France, but to the birth of our own republic. At stake is not whether we are to be a white-dominated or a black-dominated nation, but who we are as a revolutionary people. As with France, so with us. The affair of the hour points to our national character much more than to the actual controversies at hand. We're not fighting about what we think we're fighting about. We're just reenacting, as we always do, the Puritanism that is the sufficient condition for revolutionary so-called liberty. And at this point, we're going to stop and take a break, and we'll return and take up the article. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Suppose a candidate said, "I support terrorism." Would you even bother to ask his position on other issues? Support of terrorism disqualifies him from consideration. So it is with one who supports abortion. That, too, is the taking of innocent human life, and support for abortion should disqualify a candidate from consideration. This is Father Frank Pavone.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic. We're back from our break, and we're talking about an article in the New Oxford Review by Jason M. Morgan called Sons of Liberty, Sons of Anarchy. And it's an article that is getting to the deeper point of the split in our nation and what's going on today by comparing it to what happened with the Dreyfus affair in France back in the 19th century. And the same sort of rent or divide in the French nation back at that time over a person called, you know, Alfred Dreyfus, who was in the French military and accused of spying for the Germans and falsely accused at that, set French society into a sort of division and war of one side against the other. And the article here is saying that the incident with George Floyd was the same thing, and at the heart of what's going on today is not really racism or systemic racism, because we've made so many cultural gains against that all the way since the 1960s, that it's really about something deeper than that, and that's what the article is getting at and talking about. It says, the Dreyfus affair, as Arendt points out, was only approximately about anti-Semitism and much more about the formation of a post-revolutionary nation-state. In other words, a revolt against the original revolt in France. In other words, in the French Revolution of, I think it was 1789, the French Revolution was over, and there was a constant disturbance in France ever since, leading from one government to another. And there was a reaction to that revolution in the late 19th century, and it was a revolt against revolt. And the article is suggesting a lot of that is what's going on here. And I want to quote something from Mary Chestnut, who was a diarist in the South during the Civil War. And she kept a huge diary during all of the Civil War years. And there's a lot to be learned from Mary Chestnut's diary. She was a very observant person, very intelligent, very astute person. And she kept her thoughts about what was going on during the American Civil War and during the South, you know, withdrawing from the Union. And she says, she wrote in her diary, and I'll quote here, about, she invoked the memory of the first great Protestant rebels. She wrote in her diary that Martin Luther had a right to protest and free himself from the thraldom of the Roman Catholic Church. And, but then everybody began to protest against Luther as it seemed good to them, freely exercising their right of private interpretation, she said. Seceding can go on indefinitely with the dissatisfied seceders. And she was saying, you know, when does the revolution stop? In other words, there was very much of a question here. She was saying Martin Luther had the right to secede. And you can almost hear her saying in a lower voice, didn't he? And it was a question. But the problem with that kind of thing is that it goes on indefinitely. And when does the seceding stop? So this is what Jason Morgan is talking about here with the Dreyfus Affair. The revolt of revolutionaries against earlier revolutionaries, the revolt of France against its earlier revolution. And he's sort of suggesting that maybe this is getting at a little bit more what is going on here. And he says, he goes on, that Dreyfus, the bitter recriminations about Dreyfus, who came from a family of secular Jews, after all, had little to do with Judaism as a religion or a set of doctrines, and had very much to do with who would get to be part of 19th century France, in which the wild-eyed freedom and democracy mob kept up its battle against entrenched aristocrats and the moneyed classes. He was saying this is what was really going on, that it really had little to do with the issue of racial or Jewish, you know, prejudice against the Jews. And the suggestion here is that what's going on today in our own country has very little to do with race and very little to do with systemic racism and much more to do with who we are as a revolutionary people. He goes on, he says, the fact that the Rothschilds and other nominal Jews funded the elites and seemed to perpetuate the rule by social betters over the, you know, ordinary or more peasant citizens made the situation even riper for violence. But the deeper fact was that pretty much everybody was ultimately on the same side. In other words, a lot of the elites at the top were actually promoting the ideas that caused the mobs in France to revolt and to go into, you know, riots and street demonstrations and street fighting and other things that became the issues of the day. In other words, the very people in many cases that were being attacked were the people that fomented a lot of this in the first place. And isn't that what we see a lot of today? That some of the people being attacked are actually people who refuse to do anything about what the attackers are doing because down deep they know that what these people in the streets are doing are carrying out the ideas that they have been pushing for a long time.
And some of them even say, we're on your side.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any difference.
It doesn't make any difference. A lot of them are saying, we support the Black Lives Matter movement, the BLM movement, for example. And yet their shops and their stores and stuff get burned up and destroyed anyway. And then there are people at the top who are refusing to do anything about the violence because actually a lot of these people were on the same side. In fact, actually in France, what was going on, there was this anti-Semitism that was going on, and it was against people like the Rothschilds, who were very, you know, wealthy and well-off people who also happened to be Jewish. And yet some of these people were, in effect, sort of admiring the revolutionaries, even though they were targets of that revolution, because it was their ideas that they were seeing carried out on the streets, the ideas that they had been promoting. And he goes on. Morgan says, when the mob started flinging brickbats and committing arson, the elites, many of whom were Jewish, instinctively kowtowed to the terrorists. Arendt lays it out beautifully. He says, high society and politicians of the Third Republic had produced the French mob in a series of scandals and public frauds. In other words, the things that they did produced the mobs that were out in the streets. They now felt a tender sentiment of paternal familiarity with their offspring, a feeling mixed with admiration and fear. While the mob actually stormed Jewish shops and assailed Jews in the streets, the language of high society made real, passionate violence look like child's play. And isn't that what we're getting a lot from the higher-ups who are allowing all of these riots to going on? We get from the news, we hear mostly, you know, non-violent violence, mostly non-violent rioting going on, or mostly non-violent protest. What is a mostly non-violent protest? It's almost like they're trying to overlook the violence that is going on. I mean, buildings are being burned down. Businesses are being looted. People are being hurt in the streets. Policemen are being shot and killed and attacked. Bricks and, you know, rocks and other things are being thrown at them. And in other places, you know, police are being attacked by people of the same ilk as the rioters and looters. And yet a lot of higher-up people at the top have a tendency, and especially in the news media, to overlook this. In other words, they're treating violence like it's just child's play because there's a deep sympathy for the people at the top and the people at the bottom to be on the same side. As Lynn said, you know, some of the people are screaming at the rioters, we're on your side, and yet the rioters are still rioting against them anyway. It says, relatively large numbers of intellectuals and even of Jews in the list of people who wanted to see Jews torn to pieces, stewed in oil, boiled alive, and circumcised up to the neck is surprising. In other words, these were the kind of things that were being said back during the French Revolution about Jewish people. And yet there were Jews who were actually, in effect, sympathetic to this and sort of supporting it. It says the upper classes knew that the mob was flesh of their flesh and blood of their blood. Even a Jewish historian of the time, although he had seen with his own eyes that Jews are no longer safe when the mob rules the street, spoke with secret admiration of the great collective movement. And isn't this is what we have with a lot of our reporters? They seem to secretly sympathize with these rioters out in the streets as if they're progeny of their own. It says, when an American celebrity tweets her admiration for the looting of black businesses, and I'm not sure who he's referring to here, Lynn. This is Morgan.
I'm not either.
Yeah. an American celebrity tweets her admiration for the looting of black businesses. That could be a number. There have been a lot of celebrities doing this, coming out and on Twitter and so forth, talking about their admiration for what's going on. And what's going on is the looting of black businesses by people who proclaim that they're on the side of the blacks. This is similar to what was going on in France. They actually, attack of people who were supposed to be on the same side. And it says here, she doesn't do so out of racial sympathy, however misguided. In other words, when an American celebrity admires the looting of black businesses, she's not doing it out of racial sympathy, no matter what is being said about this being in favor of the blacks, that this is a Black Lives Matter movement. And he goes on, he says, this is because at heart, the mob and the cultural vandals who sit atop our social hierarchy are the same. In other words, he's saying there is a relationship between the people at the top and the people at the bottom. And he calls the people at the top cultural vandals. That is, people who are, in effect, bad-mouthing and vandalizing our culture, our American culture, from the top. And he says that this is because, at heart, the mob and the cultural vandals who sit at the top of our social hierarchy are the same. Revolution is how this country, America, runs. The middle class, most of us, largely avoid it. That more than socioeconomics is what makes it the middle class. He's saying that is the fact that we as the middle class avoid revolution is what actually really makes us the middle class far more than our financial status does. Because we prefer law and order, and we prefer things to be, in conjunction with the law, and we prefer to live our lives in peace. And we're not revolutionaries. He goes, but passionate violence, either physical or cultural, is how one becomes either rich or poor in America, and certainly how one achieves fame without warranting attention. And what he's saying here is that he's talking about these celebrities at the top. Do they really warrant the fame that they achieve? They do it by all kinds of sort of outstanding or different behavior and so forth, and performances and so forth that capture the attention of people, and they don't really warrant it from actually their accomplishments. And then he's saying, and the same thing at the bottom. There are a lot of people who are, in effect, sort of nobodies, like George Floyd, who are sort of accelerated to the top of society by simply the historical events that take place, and as George Floyd happened to be in the right place at the right time, if you want to say it that way, or the wrong place at the wrong time. But the fact is that it isn't so much that George Floyd is an outstanding person as an outstanding event happened to him that could be used to continue this revolt against the middle class society, the current state of affairs. And he goes on, he says,
it becomes a big charade.
Exactly. He says, as in France, during the Dreyfus affair, the question of the moment is not really what is on the spittle-flecked lips of American street throngers. Those shouting, say their names, do not realize it. But racism, systemic or otherwise, is not really what is agitating them. In France, it was not the Jewish question. In America, it is not blacks versus whites at all. It goes, how truly American New Left icon Tom Hayden, admirer of the Viet Cong, spoke. If you remember back in the 1960s, one of the New Left icons, Tom Hayden, along with Jane Fonda, you certainly know her, they traveled to Hanoi at the time and had their pictures taken actually sitting on a Chinese or a Vietnamese anti-aircraft gun. And Tom Hayden spoke, and he said, and he spoke the truth here. He said, the issue is never the issue. In other words, the issues that the Viet Cong and the Vietnamese, you know, the revolutionaries in Vietnam, the issues that they were actually talking about were not the real issue. And he said, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. And there we're getting at the heart of things. In other words, when you see revolutions going on, and you see things that are going on in our society like you see today, and you see things that are going on in France where a whole country is split, just like our country is being split right now, and you hear all the people mouthing all of these issues of why they are doing what they are doing, that is never really the issue, as Tom Hayden said. The real issue is always the revolution. In their hearts, and in a lot of times in their minds, but unspoken, is the fact that they want to destroy the society they're living in and change it to a society that they imagine is going to be the new society, the new millennium, the new heaven on earth. And this is what's really going on. So at this point, we're going to stop and take a break. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Are you prepared to vote?
Moral theology in our tradition also teaches us that one may not vote for an enemy of religion or of freedom, except to exclude a worse enemy of religion and of freedom.
Learn more so you're prepared when you vote this November. Visit EWTN.com/vote for everything Catholic voters need to know before picking up a ballot.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here at Catholic Spirit Radio. And we're talking about an article in the New Oxford Review entitled Sons of Liberty and Sons of Anarchy. And it's talking about what is really going on in our American society today, what is really happening in the streets and what is really happening with the split in our society. And it's the article is saying, in effect, things are never as they really seem to be, and the issue is never really the issue. And we've gotten to the whole rub of the article, and that is that in all of these things, the issue is really the revolution. He says, this is the rub, not race, but revolution. Principle is nothing, victory is all. This is, paradoxically, the very essence of liberty. It is tyranny, period. Rousseau fretted about this too, but not for long. Those who do not want to be free just have to be forced to get with the program. In other words, Rousseau said, those who don't want to be free have to be forced to be free. And this is what Morgan is saying actually has went on with the American Revolution and goes on with most revolutions. That was enough for his conscience, and it's enough for those who are now enrolled in the Arson for Freedom program. Give me liberty, or I give you death. If you don't accept that, then you cannot be a good American. If you don't praise the burning of a church next door to the White House, then you have somehow failed Civics 101. Pretty rough statements to make, but he goes on to support what he says. He says, there is a strain of self-righteous hysteria in our national DNA. It midwifed the birth of our republic and will also likely euthanize it eventually. We don't need to look to France to find a precedent for the present bout of bum-it-all, a burn-it-all cultural iconoclasm. We can find all of today's insanity and so much more right thick in the company of Sam Adams and Tom Paine. Despite attempts by so-called American conservatives to explain away the founding terrorism of our nation, the Sons of Liberty were examples of the brand of Puritan hellenism, and there it is, the relationship to religion and perhaps the relationship to the Catholic Church. That brand of Puritan hellenism, which is our birthright. The current round of histrionia liberalensis is not an exception to the American experience. It is the American experience. Anyone educated in the United States probably will have seen pictures in a history textbook of patriots tarring and feathering British government officials, pouring scalding tea down the throats of tax collectors, or puckishly breaking wind in the direction of a poster of King George III. This is not, I would argue, the origin of ordered liberty. This is vandalism, or worse, violent assault. Whatever order and peace were achieved in America, it was despite the Sons of Liberty, not because of them. One does not build a society by tormenting shopkeepers. And you'll notice that after the American Revolution was over, if you read about the Revolution, actually many of the rebels had to be put down by the new government and a whole new order imposed upon America. As Greg L. Fraser makes clear in God Against the Revolution, 2018, if some scholars today have finally come to refer to the Sons of Liberty as a street gang, there is a good reason for that assessment. They were a street gang. As a matter of practice, not exception, Fraser writes, Americans who would later celebrate their Bill of Rights denied to loyalists virtually every right in the list. And isn't that what the left does and what liberalism has come to? Proclaiming liberty for itself and denying liberty for everybody else, using violence against anyone who disagrees with them. And not just officials, but those of all stripes who remain loyal to the crown. See if any of the following examples from the 1770s sounds familiar to you. At the hands of self-appointed groups and mobs, loyalists suffered ostracism, persecution, loss of property, banishment or exile, personal assaults and threats, prison or other means of confinement, and death. Loyalists were denied freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, due process of law, and other rights. More importantly, at the time, those demanding their rights as Englishmen felt free to deny the rights of Englishmen to anyone who disagreed with them. And isn't that what we're seeing today? The outrages that Fraser catalogs have happened over the past few months to those who dare to question even a jot or tittle of the party line, which not coincidentally is exactly the line taken by the seething, bomb-throwing mob, as in France in the 1890s, as in the colonies in the 1770s, so today. The issue is always the revolution, and the upper classes know full well that the only way to get ahead is by paying homage from time to time to so-called freedom fighters with liberty in their diseased imaginations. The mob will accept nothing less, and the mob knows exactly how to separate the compliant from those who dare to think for themselves. The liberty gangs in the 1770s declared days of prayer and fasting, and then they spied on ministers and other subjects to see whether they complied. Those who did not pray and fast at the hour appointed by the so-called patriots were deemed heretics and denounced, even assaulted or worse. Loyalty to the king is now treason to our country, a Boston town meeting declared in May 1776. And you have it today. Loyalty to the current regime is treason, according to the modern street gangs today. The lines had been drawn, and absolute commitments to some nebulous liberty, not race, not religion, not even politics, but pure submission to the mob, was the criterion of belonging in the 1770s colonial America. Absolute submission to the mob is the criterion today, too. Kneel or else. Cry Black Lives Matter or go begging. Defund the police or you're a brown shirt. The Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre, when the mob threw rocks and bottles at the equivalent of the police, the war whooping and tomahawk brandishing, the burning down of any businesses or church owned by someone whose opinion varied from one's own, though these and a thousand other examples from our history, to say nothing of France's, are being replayed in our own time. If we are to celebrate Puritan hellions running mean old British officials out of town on a rail and sending loyalist businesses up in flames, as we have been taught to do by our history teachers, then we are going to have to celebrate Puritan hellions burning down low-income housing developments in Minnesota and setting fast food joints ablaze in Atlanta. Race is only proximately what the Floyd affair is about. This is evident when the anti-racist, anti-fascist, racist fascists, or Antifa gleefully throw bricks through black-owned storefront windows and torch restaurants lovingly built up and tended to by generations of black families. Those fires don't rage for George Floyd. This is not anti-racism. This is anarchy. The sons of anarchy are just sons of liberty with soy lattes and skinny jeans. America has always been a place where Puritanism has either held sway or threatened to. Puritanism, so naturally coupled with hellenism, is our national character. Consider the Civil War. Having chosen Lincoln as their Alexander, a group of Puritan-minded terrorists, known as the Wide Awakes, began marching through the streets of big cities and small towns, torches burning in the night, shouting slogans of sheer intimidation against anyone who would not vote Republican in the 1860 election. Now, these were people on the side of the North, on the side of Lincoln, but most of them really didn't know what was going on. Some of them wouldn't know Republicanism from an oak tree. I mean, they were out with torches, screaming in the night, simply raising hell is what they were doing. The Wide Awakes didn't care about race. They didn't care about anything, really, except confirming to their satisfaction that everyone had duly submitted to their demands. And notice the history there. Notice the progression. In the beginning of our country, along with the, you know, sort of like coming from the Protestant Reformation, which was really a revolution, we had the Great Awakening. Remember that if you've studied history? The Great Awakening, where you had all this religious fervor that was going on, and all of these new cults and sects came into existence, and they were all anti-Catholic, basically, all rebelling against the Catholic Church. And then, of course, during the Civil War, you had the Wide Awakes. And what do we have today, Lynn?
The Awakening.
The Wokes, right?
Wokes.
They call them the Wokes. All the news media and so forth, all the Wokes. You had the Great Awakening. You had the Wide Awakes, and now the Wokes. And these people have been on various sides, from being on the side of the South to the side of the North, throughout our history. And you see it also through the history of other events.
Of the world. But if you take a look at it, with the side they choose to be on, they'll be on this side today, and 10 years are on that, the opposite side. It's whatever side is going to gain them control.
Exactly. This is the whole thing. This is what we're talking about here. This is what Tom Hayden said, and this is the actual real issue. It's never the issue of the day. The revolution. Revolution itself is always the issue. And we're going to get, to the bottom of that a little bit more. It says, the woke mob of today is not one whit different from the Wide Awakes of 160 years ago. The racial problems of the United States are real, but they never get solved by Puritan hellions, because Puritan hellions don't care about race. They care about demonstrating their own ideological purity. And if anyone disagrees, watch out. Documents from 1860 amply attested the fact that, more than anything, the Wide Awakes showed up to brawl. Again, they might have been proclaiming they were on the side of liberty, they were proclaiming they were on the side of the Union, proclaiming that they were preserving the country. Those were all slogans. Most of them were out there for one thing, to tear down whatever was in existence, you know, currently at the time, to attack, in effect, the middle-class tranquility, and to raise hell. That's what they were out doing. Rival gangs found themselves hurling bricks back and forth with the wideawakes. One gang was trapped on a rooftop when a wideawakes detachment knowingly set fire to the building. And this is a lot of this stuff has been going on today. Like the two lawyers who hurled a Molotov cocktail at a cop car in Brooklyn this spring, the wideawakes had no political agenda per se. All they needed was a pretext. The violence flowed naturally once the dam broke. In his American Conservative piece, Collins cites Barbara Tuchman's observation that Dreyfus became an abstraction for two sides in a cultural war. But this must be extended past the racial question in America and into a consideration of America as a whole. This is about more than culture. This is about national character. And that includes Americans of every race and creed. Here is Collins' key point. There could be no peace between the France of the Counter-Revolution and the France of 1789. In other words, the Counter-Revolution in the 1890s was actually opposing the original revolution of 1789. Just as there is no reconciling conservatives who still revere America's history and institutions and a newly ascendant left that questions their very legitimacy. In other words, what's going on today is a revolt against the revolution. The liberalism of yesteryear, which emphasized the fealty to the country's ideals while pressing the urgency of reform, seems antiquated and obsolete to today's rebels. Conservatives are indeed defending American history. That is noble and fine, but history is a tricky thing and rarely lies in the shape we hope it will. American history is a particularly odd origami bird. Unfold what appears to be a high-flying eagle, and suddenly you get a wacky dodo prone to wild spasms of wheezing and quacking over apparently nothing at all. We Americans would do well to get acquainted with the dodo half of our history, so to understand better why we keep flying off the rails. Conservatives, especially, should take this opportunity to ask themselves whether what they are defending in the past would be welcome to them today. For my part, Morgan says, I would be appalled to see perfectly good tea dumped into a harbor by armed hooligans in the equivalent of blackface, wouldn't you? Today's racially charged conflagrations beg a much bigger question. Why are Americans so prone to absolutizing and aggrandizing? In shrieking in the streets, the American left does not question the legitimacy of America's history and institutions as conservatives fear. The left affirms American history with gusto. What self-styled conservatives defend, these progressives carry out. Can we admit it? We Americans are a revolutionary people, whatever our skin color. When die-hard right-wingers are called Minutemen, originally assassins of crown officials, what can one say? There is hardly a single conservative in the United States who does not swell with pride over the American Revolution, and then that same conservative recoils in horror when the revolutionaries of the moment march down his sleepy suburban street, shouting into bullhorns. We are a country born of Puritan hellenism, and after April 1865, that cultural bacillus finally infected us all. No, those are not Dreyfusards torching a federal courthouse in Portland. They are our very own homegrown hooligans, absolutely convinced, as Americans always are, of the purity of their own motives and righteousness of their own histories. And ultimately, this is all boils down to the revolution. That's always the real issue. And where does the revolution come from, and what does it have to do with Catholicism? Ultimately, it comes from the first rebel, and his name was Lucifer, and he said, "I will not serve." And that is basically why Catholicism has a point in this whole thing, because it stands for the church that will prevail, and the forces of hell will not prevail against it. So ultimately, revolution comes from the first revolutionary, and that's Lucifer, and Lucifer stands against the first Christian church, which is the Catholic Church. Revolution is always a religious issue, and the issues of the day are always religious. They're never what they seem to be. The issue is never the issue. It's always the revolution, and the revolution is always about the first revolutionary, and that is Satan, and that's what we as Catholics need to remember.
Listen carefully, as much as you can, to EWTN. They're explaining what's going on very clearly, and you'll hear about the letter from
from Archbishop Viganò.
You know, to our president. He outlines what could be laying ahead for us. And do so before you go vote, if possible. Because we are headed for totalitarianism.
We'll have to end our program with that. So, St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him. We humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.